to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Later in the hour, I'll be talking to award-winning novelist and poet Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni about her short story collection, Arranged Marriage, and her latest novel, Before We Visit the Goddess. Professor Divakaruni will be in Chico this weekend for Butte College's 5th Annual WordSpring Creative Writing Conference, which is open to the public as well as high school and college students. My guest today was born in what was at the time East Prussia. After her maternal grandfather received deportation papers to Auschwitz, young Gudrun Walker became a refugee. She arrived at the United States with her parents as a displaced person when she was 7 years old. In the 1960s, she moved to California and studied at San Jose State University. In 1969, she received a master's degree in English literature and then worked at Stanford University's Graduate Library. Now Gudrun Mao has also worked as a community college teacher, a columnist, a California poet in the schools. She received yoga instructor certification from the Integral Yoga Institute and teaches yoga and meditation. Her poems have won awards and have appeared in literary journals, and her first novel, her first book, Wife of the House, is a collection of her poems. She has now written a novel, From Ashes into Light. Gudrun Mao, welcome.
Thank you.
Why can't people find East Prussia on a map today?
Because it doesn't exist anymore. Part of it went to Russia and part of it went to Poland.
So where, if people wanted to look on a map at more or less where you were born, where would they look in the what general area?
In the Russian area now.
Near?
What used to be Königsberg, which is now Kaliningrad.
So on the Baltic?
Yes.
Yes. Well, you wrote this as a novel. You could have written a memoir because your life has been so interesting. I would think it would be very tempting to write a memoir if I were you.
Well, I found that when I started to want to write a piece of fiction, that if I was able to detach from my own story, it was much more creative. It freed me up. It allowed the character to evolve in different unexpected ways. It made it fun.
Also, you have a lot of dialogue in your book, and if you were writing a memoir, you couldn't be certain who said what and
right.
how they said it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you were free to write the dialogue
exactly.
as you wanted.
Exactly.
Well, your book starts in Austria, your novel.
Yes.
And you give us the name of the character.
Yes.
Who is a young woman who at the time is 12 years old.
Yes.
And I'd like you to read the opening section of your novel.
November 10th, 1938. Kristallnacht. Night of shattered glass, broken bodies, and broken faith. We are propelled into a chaotic world. Our Salzburg home has been torn apart. I stare at drawers emptied on the floor, papers thrown about, clothes everywhere, and my 12-year-old mind cannot comprehend. Papa, where are Oma Gutherz and Uncle David? Did they go to the doctor? When will they be back? Who made this mess? We have just returned from visiting Stefan and Anna Richert, and Papa wants to go back to the Richerts and make inquiries. Mother nearly yells, Josef, they should be taken away. An old woman taking care of her son, sick in bed. This I cannot believe. Esther, believe it. Haven't we been trying to convince you, Stefan and I? The Nazis have no mercy. We are lost. The pain in my father's voice shocks me. I think, how can Papa say lost? Grandmother Gutherz and Uncle David must be somewhere. What are we going to do, Josef? We have to do something. Mother stands in the midst of our ransacked apartment. Forgetting danger, she begins to cry loudly. Quiet. Please be quiet, Papa whispers. Mother chokes back sound. What do you think we can do, Esther? Don't you understand what's been happening since the Nazis took control? Before turning to the Lichets, Papa warns, keep it dark. Stay still. Don't open the door. He points to an overturned lamp and pictures from the walls smashed on the floor in a pile of splintered glass. The place has been well gone over. It's unlikely anyone will be back here tonight. Mother and I huddle on the divan, afraid to talk. I hug my knees tightly. Forehead presses bone. Mother makes suppressed noises, and her thick body heaves. How can I help? What can I say? When Papa returns, he whispers, Stefan went to the Gestapo. He said he wanted to report breaking and entering and destruction of property. The Gestapo told him they already knew and not to bother about it. To cover himself, he pretended to be pleased, saying, good, good, they got what they deserved. Then he heard someone give an order to send a telegram to Vienna about Salzburger Jews taken in protective custody. Stefan thinks Vienna is their immediate destination, but someone else told him that those arrested would eventually be sent to a camp in Germany near Munich. He and I agree. We need to leave as soon as possible. He will take care of the business and send us money.
And this is Gudrun Mao. She's reading from a novel, From Ashes into Light. And that was not the original title that you considered.
No.
What was your original title?
Phoenix Feather.
Phoenix Feather. And then it went from Phoenix Feather to...
Out of the Ashes.
Because Phoenix rises out of the ashes.
Right. And from that, from ashes into light.
And it sounds like Out of the Ashes would be a good title for a novel about a phoenix.
I think there were a lot of other titles like that. It was apparently a popular title.
Well, this scene that you were just reading and the dialogue that you were just reading is taking place on Kristallnacht. And we are familiar with that, but how were you so familiar with it that you could write a dialogue like that?
I did a lot of reading and studying and research.
So you created these characters of Ruth, the young 12-year-old, and her mother Esther, and her father Joseph. So these characters came totally from, based on your reading and studying of this time in history.
Well, not completely. I was at a yoga retreat many years ago, and my teacher, Swami Satchidananda, invited a friend of his, Rabbi Gelberman, and he gave a beautiful talk. And I was very interested in what he had to say. And then he made almost like an offhand comment. He said, well, you know, I think that maybe Holocaust victims reincarnated as yogis. And that somehow moved me very much. And that was the beginning, I think.
You think that was when you first decided, I want to write a book about this, tell this story?
Not at the time, but it stuck with me. And it wasn't until after I had started working on this book, where I was focusing more on the East Prussians part of the story. And but we took a trip to Europe, and we went to a synagogue in Prague, and that was just going inside there was so incredibly moving. And then I heard a lady came in, and she started chanting, Shalom. It was like the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And that's, I think, when the character gelled for me.
Well, now, when you say we, I'm assuming your daughter Erica was part of that.
Yes. Yes.
Could she understand how touched you were? I mean, was she as moved? Because she didn't have the experiences that you did.
Yeah.
Born in California, I assume.
Yeah.
And so how did you convey to her how meaningful that was?
You know, we discussed that, and she saw how affected I was. We went to a cemetery nearby there, a Jewish cemetery, and I was just crying and crying and crying, and she was holding my hand, and a woman came up to us, a German lady, and invited us to the opera. And Erica understood right away that we were in no condition to go to the opera. So she was very intuitive and understanding in that way.
So this is with the first chapter of your book that you were just writing.
Yes.
Now, I mentioned the fact that the Phoenix is not a part of our typical knowledge of what was happening at this time in the world. In world history. And yet chapter 2 says, I have seen many things as Phoenix. Now, what is that? What do you mean
well,
by that?
Well, the original myth is that the Phoenix is reborn. So I thought in terms of cycles, because the yogis also talk about cycles of life. And so that intrigued me about that original myth of the phoenix. And as the phoenix evolved, it kind of became the voice of my teacher, you know, or the idea in yoga of the bodhisattva, the compassionate one, the one who helps people and wants to help people in any way.
So you introduced the phoenix into your story.
Yeah.
Well, in this story, a few pages on, the characters mention that it's against the law for Jews to consider themselves as Austrian anymore.
Yes.
And the conditions got worse and worse, as we know. The father in your story, Joseph, is beaten by the SS. And then Ruth has a dream. She dreams she is a baby lying in the snow in a northeast country.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have dreams that were meaningful to you?
Yes, yes. I think we all do. Mm-hmm. We all have dreams that we don't know where they come from and what is happening. And yes, yes.
So you have your character Ruth, the young woman who starts in the story. She's 12 years old. And also you mentioned the yogic training that you have had. And then there's a point of gazing and staring into a mirror. And I wondered, did you have this experience? Can you stare into a mirror and see things?
Yes. It's a really intriguing practice. And I came across it first in a book of Hasidic practices. I believe I did a lot of reading during that time. And so it apparently isn't just in a yogic way to practice gazing, which I learned from my teacher. And so I was excited to see that there were other traditions that saw things, you know, beyond the ordinary.
Well, in this story, of course, we know things get continually worse. And at one point, Ruth asked for help from that which cannot be named.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that how you feel about a source of help, if you wanted to ask for help from that which cannot be named?
In some traditions, the idea of something higher than the self, in some traditions, that's that which cannot be named. Or other people will name it one way or the other. And that can sometimes divide people. You know, my way is the better way.
Or the only
way. Yeah, or the only way.
Yeah. Well, in the story, the mother, Esther, is trying to get papers so they can leave. And I'd like you to read this. It's on page 87, Gudrun. And the mother is, of course, Esther. And what has happened to the father at this point in your story?
He was supposedly been sent to do labor. And that was one of the tricks they used to get rid of the householders. And in fact, that was what they tried to do to my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
They take the head of the household and on some pretext, deportation, labor, they need war labor.
Carpenters, technicians.
Whatever. And
so it's all on the mother's shoulders. It's all on Esther's shoulders to take care of the family. So why don't you start reading there in chapter 14.
Esther Gutherz has never liked the idea of going to England, since she and her husband's brother, Franz, do not get along. She is afraid to reside in a land where she cannot speak the language. She packs as if she is angry as I listen to the conversation between my aunt and my mother. I would go with you in a minute, Esther, Aunt Lily says, but I'd have to sell the house for practically nothing. I don't think they will kick me out since the house belonged to my dear husband, who died while still in the diplomatic service to the country. And as you know, he wasn't Jewish, so that may make a difference. And I'm still able to help people. Who thought it would come to this? So many have lost their jobs, their homes. At least you and Ruth have a place to go. Thousands want to get out, yet there's no place willing to take them.
This is my guest, Gudrun Mau, reading from her novel, From Ashes into Light. And the mother is trying to get papers. And would you read then, would you pick up again on the next page, where it says, in the afternoon, my mother returns. And the telling this first person, the young woman, Ruth.
In the afternoon, my mother returns from the immigration office. She leans inside the doorframe to the kitchen and refuses her sister-in-law's suggestion to sit. Tears trickle down my mother's cheeks. I can't bear to watch. I look at the floor, not knowing what else to do. Auntie, small and thin, always moving, ever efficient, quickly begins to make my mother a cup of tea. She frowns as she scrapes out the last of a tin she had been stretching for months. There won't be any more, I suddenly recognize. The rations for Jews are much, much worse than for the general population. I take my mother by the arm and help her to a chair. She sinks heavily to the seat and lets her arms fall, as if she doesn't have the strength to hold them anymore. Her jaws drop, her cheeks collapse like a falling cake. Some papers are missing, she says bitterly. They persist in getting rid of us, so why do they make difficulties? We didn't lose the papers, but we have to pay again. Why this delay? There is really no time left, nearly no time left on our passports. I think perhaps fate has intervened. Perhaps Papa is meant to return to us here. If we have to stay longer, it might be easier for Papa to reunite with us. I say, hopefully. No, my dear, we are past that point. But I still have savings left in my widow's pension, my aunt offers. Mother shakes her head. You have your own problems. No, Yosef wished, and I also wish, you should both be safe. You've already put so much effort into this. I insist. So mother goes off to the same offices, making the rounds once again. New papers are signed and stamped. She fills out an additional form. More money is paid. Everything must be validated and checked by the Gestapo. The papers are promised the day we are supposed to leave. I hear the front door slam. My stomach contracts. Mother calls out even before reaching the kitchen. The papers aren't ready. Family providers have lost their businesses, their homes. People are arrested for no reason. Husbands and fathers have been taken away from their wives and children.
This is the novel From Ashes into Light by Gudrun Mau. And she was born in what is today Germany, but at the time was East Prussia. And you were actually born just before the war ended. You were born in 1944.
That's right.
So
that's right.
You couldn't have lived these experiences of the young woman who was born and was 12 years old at this time in 1938. So the mother is trying to get these papers. And so what happens then to the family?
Well, the family is separated, and the Ruth character, the young woman is taken to a train station to be deported.
And eventually, she finds herself in Dachau. And this later, obviously, in your book. And she quotes, she has some interesting quotes in this section. For example, she mentions what a rabbi says, that the same essence exists at the heart of all religions. And that's really what you've been saying, is you've been referring to different religions, that the same essence exists at the heart of all religions. And then you quote the father in this story that the young woman remembers, that we may easily become that which we hate, especially when we get stuck in our own narrow opinions.
Yes. I learned that at an early age when I was living, came to the West, and I went to school, and my mother kept the Sabbath, and I was really tormented by because in Germany, you have to go to school half day on Saturday. And I didn't do that, so I was pegged as a Jew.
We'd call it today bullying. Would you say that was the case for you, that you were bullied by others?
Oh, yes. Beaten, all kinds of things, yes.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well,
so I could relate a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, the night then you were going on now that she's having this conversation with a friend, Maria. And you, in the book, Maria and I manage to stay next to each other. We hear sounds cracking behind us. And you say, I remember telling Maria once, you chose your fate. I didn't. She had said, possibly we choose more than we know. And then the Ruth replies, no, no, I didn't choose to be a Jew. So here they are, Maria and Ruth, these two friends. And then they go into this place where there's a wall. And what happens then? This is on page 104 in your book.
Should I read that part?
Yes, read that part if you would.
Now the wall grows a hole. The hole in the wall fills with light as the wall becomes more and more lucid and transparent. A well-wisher behind me says, die fast. Maria squeezes my hand once again softly. I'm barely able to feel her touch. An exquisite light flows through me. My entire being pulses in a way I have never experienced before. Is this the ecstasy of which Papa used to speak? I squeezed Maria's hand in return, but I can't tell where her hand begins and mine ends. No earthly power commands us. Already we are in a better place. There are no Jews, no Christians, no Muslims here. Our bodies stand naked and cold at the brink of death. Yet inside us burns a freedom nothing can destroy. The row behind us drops with fumbling, crumbling sounds, as if there is hardly any mass to the bodies. I hear other noises between gunshots, a moan, a quick cry, ended with a shot, the cracking of bones. Bullets whirl fast and close. Something hits my back hard. So many shots fly at us. We bloom like red roses, our limbs falling to the ground. We spray in every direction, and the wall floats away. Holding hands, even after falling, I thrust my other arm towards Maria, but the force of gravity goes against me. My body can do nothing more. Physical movement ceases. I forget the body. I forget the mind. Silence settles around us, timeless, endless. Out of the dark comes a light of awareness. I am free. I am floating. I don't need the body. The light grows and grows. Light pervades every fiber of my spirit. Stillness fills me. How long does this last? Perhaps time doesn't pass. Perhaps everything happens all at once. I might be dreaming, or I might be awake, gazing like a stranger at the globe that was once my home. Below, bodies are burning. Wings have risen from the ashes.
This is poet and novelist Gudrun Mau, and we see the poet in you. We hear that in this passage.
Oh, thank
Gudrun.
You.
The next chapter starts out, I have come out of fire and ashes. And there is, like the phoenix, rising out of fire and ashes.
That's right.
You describe what is happening here. And in case people didn't understand the mystic vocabulary, maybe, of your describing it, what is actually happening to these two young girls?
What is happening to the...
Maria and Ruth in that last scene.
Oh, yes. They die. But in their death, they have a transcendence.
Because if she starts out, she's the main character you're talking about, and then she dies before halfway into the story. And so,
yeah. And I wanted to show that there is a continuity of sorts. I wanted to show in all things there's a kind of continuity.
Well, you tell your story, and sometimes you have some German in there, which you might expect. This takes place in, for example, Austria. You have some Spanish sprinkled in there, and you have one other language in there in the book, and you have a short glossary at the end of your book that includes German, Chumash, and Spanish.
Yes.
So, yes. And people are reading your book, if they want to check back at your your vocabulary there, if they
yes.
or the glossary, if they forget some of these terms that you're using in your story, because when you came here, you didn't speak much English. You'd been studying.
No, I hadn't. I didn't speak any English. It was really horrible, actually, horribly embarrassing.
And yet, you become an English teacher. How appropriate.
Yes. And I was told by one of my professors I would never be able to write in the English language.
Well, look at you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Gudrun.
Thank you.
The novel is From Ashes into Light.
After a break, I'll be talking to author and creative writing professor Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni about arranged marriages and the immigrant experience in the United States, which she explores in her award-winning books. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Award-winning novelist Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni was born in Kolkata, India. She received a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and is now a professor of writing at the University of Houston. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly. Two of her novels, as well as a short story, were adapted into films, and her short story collection, Arranged Marriage, won an American Book Award in 1995. Her works are mostly set in India and the United States, and often focused on the experience of South Asian immigrants. She writes for children as well as adults, and her novels include realistic fiction, magical realism, and fantasy. Professor Divakaruni will be in Chico this weekend for Butte College's 5th annual WordSpring Creative Writing Conference. This is a one-day event tomorrow on the Butte College campus, and it includes workshops in poetry, fiction, memoir, journaling, food writing, songwriting, and nature writing. WordSpring is open to the public as well as high school and college students. And Chitra Divakaruni, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, you know, a lot of writers get their hopes up that their novels or their books are going to be made into movies, and it typically doesn't happen. So how are you so lucky?
Well, you know, what can I say? The universe has been kind. But maybe it's also because, you know, it's part of it is just being at the right place at the right time and writing about things that touch a chord in people. Mm-hmm. I think also I'm writing about a culture that is very, very moving, enthralling, touching, and picturesque, all of those things. Maybe that appeals to movie makers. And I think ultimately maybe it's that there's a lot of drama, a lot of human drama in my stories. People who have been put, by virtue of immigration many times, in situations that's very different from what they were used to. So their lives are transformed. They're facing deep challenges. And how they come out of those challenges is the matter of the book. And maybe those things apply to, you know, well to the screen.
Yeah, because sometimes the reader, in my case, I'll be reading along and all of a sudden, oh my goodness, look what happens to this character. And it's something I didn't expect to happen. So
Yeah, and I really like that. I like twists and turns in the story. I like unexpected things happening. And I also like to create visually. I'm very fond of the visual image myself. I used to be a painter until some years back. And so maybe that makes, you know, images appear when people read my books, and perhaps the director thinks, oh, this would translate well onto the screen.
My guest is Chitra Divakaruni, and she writes novels, she writes short stories, and you have a book of poetry that intrigues those of us who live in the North State, because the title of it is Leaving Yuba City.
That's right. Yes, you're not so far from that yourself, right? You're not so far from that area.
That's right. And why did you write a book of poems called Leaving Yuba City?
Well, this collection of poems has several interconnected poems, and one such series of poems is titled Leaving Yuba City. And it actually, segment is titled Yuba City Poems. So these are poems about the earliest Indian immigrants who came to Yuba City. As you probably know, there's a strong contingent of Indian immigrants now living in Yuba City. And so there are 5 poems, and they trace different periods of their history. And the final poem is about a young woman who feels now that she has to leave Yuba City and she has to set out for a greater America, where she will be away from family and she will be able to be her own person and to integrate into America.
I do know about that community. In fact, when I go through Yuba City, I often take advantage of the opportunity to go to a restaurant or a bakery there and pick up some food. Which reminds me, in your collection of short stories called Arranged Marriage, you include a glossary, and a lot of the terms in that glossary are food terms. You mentioned that these are words from mostly Bengali and Hindi. And it's very helpful because you're reading along the story and you can just flip back to the glossary. But a lot of the terms are food terms in your glossary.
Yes, food is very important in my books, in all of my books, from Arranged Marriage, which is my first book of prose, to Before We Visit the Goddess, which is my newest book that's coming out in April, you know, right around now. Mm-hmm. So food is important in my books because I really believe that, especially for the immigrant, food symbolizes a lot more than, you know, what we're putting in our mouths. It's our culture. It's what we can carry from our homeland. It's a way of teaching our children lessons. Maybe parenting lessons are taught through food and cooking. And it's just a very deep part of our identity. It's a place where we go to for comfort when we feel like we're losing other aspects of our culture. And that's why food plays a dramatic role in a lot of my books.
Well, now you mentioned your collection, Arranged Marriage, and a lot of it does have to do with marriages that the whole idea is so foreign to Westerners in a lot of cases, not all Westerners, but a lot of us can't imagine having an arranged marriage. And I would like for you to read from your book. There's a short story called Affair, and this is on page 235 in your book. And the woman uses some terms like, she mentions an apsara, which is a mythological nymph. And is there anything else that you might need to explain about this person who's talking? Because it's total in the first person, who the person speaking is. And she mentions a friend named Mina. And I was wondering if you could tell us, before you read that section, anything we need to know before you read it to us.
Sure. So this is from the story Affair. And this is, our narrator has been married in an arranged marriage. And, you know, she is now in America and she's facing a whole other culture. And she's just had a fight with her husband, and she's looking back on her marriage right now. And her best friend that she refers to is Mina. And the reason she's just had a fight with her husband is because he's told her that Mina is having an affair. And she's very upset because Mina hasn't told her anything like that. So I'll read you a paragraph.
Okay.
Even under the best of circumstances, I am no beauty. If my horoscope hadn't matched Ashok's so perfectly that everyone declared our marriage must have been ordained by the gods, I doubt that his family would have chosen me. I don't have Mina's fair skin, so dramatic with her curly black hair and long lashes. My nose is broad and honest, but by no means elegant, while hers, sharp, straight and chisel sharp, looks as though it belonged on an apsara from classical Indian sculpture. So an apsara is a heavenly maiden. I constantly battle the inches that accumulate almost by magic around my hips. I put on a pound every time I look at dessert, while Mina glides through life slim and svelte, eating whatever she wants and wearing designer bikinis. You could look really pretty, Abha, she laments periodically, but you don't even try. She's shown me how to pull in my stomach and push back my shoulders when I walk, but I invariably forget. And when I'm forced by necessity to venture into the mall, I always pick up clothing with bright, flowery patterns instead of the dark solids and narrow stripes she's advised me to wear. So here we have two women, very different, one of whom has embraced the Western world. The other one, she's still, our narrator, she's still struggling to find her place in it. Both of them have been brought to America by virtue of their arranged marriages, but now both of them have chosen very different paths. So this story, as well as many stories in arranged marriage, these stories are about the situations in which men and women find themselves when they've come from a very different culture. And especially these stories, which I wrote in the 90s, in the pre-internet era, this was a time when immigrants didn't know that much about America necessarily.
In fact, I did when I came across the name of where you were born, Calcutta, and in your book it was still spelled Calcutta. And so you wrote this before that name, the spelling was changed.
That's right. And in my latest book, Before We Visit the Goddess, now it's spelled Kolkata, mm-hmm. the way we spell it now. Yes, lots of things have changed in the world.
Well, in this section that you were just reading from us, because this woman, the narrator speaking, does freelance work from home. She writes recipes. And she says, well, I don't need to look good. And then her friend says, really, Abba? And she's shaking her head like there was no hope for me. All women need to look good.
Yes.
Don't you want your husband's heartbeat to speed up when he looks at you? And then the narrator says, it made me laugh out loud.
Right, because the narrator has an older, more traditional idea of marriage where you are partners for life and you're going to bring up a family, and that's what's important. And to her friend, Amina, romance has become really important. And so that's like a kind of battle at the heart of the whole idea of the Indian marriage. Although I have to say Indian arranged marriages have changed a great deal even since I wrote this story. And now often the young people, the families will connect them, but then they get together, they make sure that they really like each other, and then they decide if they want to marry each other. So, arranged marriage too has kind of morphed.
You also mentioned the narrator remembering her mother. She said she doubted that her mother ever made her father's heartbeat speed up, even though he loved her, at least not in the 30 years that she had known them. And then her friend chides her and says, you're starting to sound like an American.
Yes, yes.
And says, Indian marriages aren't based on such superficial things.
Right, right. Although I think even in India, things are changing a great deal. And, we have one of the biggest movie industries in India, Bollywood, and romantic comedies or romantic dramas are very, very popular in Bollywood. So I think, the idea of romance in marriage or before marriage is becoming more and more popular.
And you do have humor in your books, too. There's pathos but there is humor, too, in your books.
Well, I definitely want that humor laced in with the serious things, because I think if I can make a reader laugh, well, that's a big accomplishment right there. So in this story, which is in many ways a serious story, Ava is very upset with her husband, and she's like, what can I do back to him? And she decides to put extra chili pepper in his chicken because, he has a very finicky stomach.
But then he bypasses that and orders pizza.
That's right. He knows her tricks better than she knows them. So he wins that one. He wins that round by ordering pizza.
And she's not even sure to believe when her husband tells her that her friend is having an affair. She's not even sure. And so you have her write down on a yellow sheet, why is Mina having an affair if she's having one? And how wrong is it what she's doing if she's doing it? And should I confront her about it?
Right, 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 right. Yes, this story is all about relationships, the complexities of our relationships. How much can we believe people? How much are we hurt when they do things that we didn't believe they could do? And, ultimately, what is friendship? What's friendship all about? What's marriage all about? And although it is set in the Indian context, I hope in this book, as with many of my books, that these are universal questions that readers will relate.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chicha Divakaruni, and we were talking about some of her stories in her collection, Arranged Marriage. And in this story, we have the narrator using the first person. But I thought it was interesting, you have a story in your book that is told in the second person. And this
That's right.
this is your short story called The Word Love.
Yes, I wanted to experiment with the second person because, you know, I came to writing kind of through the back door. I never really attended a writing program. I was always studying to teach in college. But later, after I'd finished all my studies, I decided that writing was very important for me. So I was, you know, taking maybe a workshop here and a workshop there, just pretty much like the workshops that will be held at Butte College. And they were very helpful to me. But in one of those workshops, I remember the professor saying, oh, you can write in first person and you can write in third person, but you really can't write a story in second person. That's just too difficult. And I said, boy, I have to set myself that
He threw down the gauntlet.
Yes, in fact,
as I read that, I thought, my goodness, I do believe this is the first time, because I've read a lot of things in first person and third person, but I don't ever recall reading one that was written in the second person.
It's very rare to find a story in the second person, but I felt that this worked very well for this story where this young woman has come to America, she's going to school. She's become very westernized. She's embraced many American traditions. She's fallen in love with a young man, and she's moved in with him. Now, she comes from a very traditional family. Her widowed mother brought her up, and she hasn't dared to tell her mother about the situation. And in the course of the story, of course, as you might imagine, the mother will find out, and what happens after that is the rest of the story. But I wanted to use the you voice because it's like this young woman is at war with herself, mm-hmm. and she addresses herself and she's trying to understand her life and the changes that have occurred. And she's trying to almost, as it were, advise herself. So there was a split in the narrator's personality, and I wanted to bring that out by using the you voice.
Well, just to give listeners an idea of what we mean, you open this short story. The first sentence is, you practice them out loud for days in front of the bathroom mirror, the words with which you'll tell your mother you're living with a man. And then later on, you'd washed your face, but he knew right away that you'd been crying. So that's an unusual way of telling this story. But so much about this story, I mean, it's taking place in Berkeley. And I couldn't help but imagine that since you went to Berkeley yourself.
I did go to Berkeley. In fact, a lot of my Yuba City stories and my interest in Yuba City came because I met several people at Berkeley who had grown up in Yuba City and had left Yuba City.
And your narrator, well, the person telling this in you, is in Berkeley and her mother is in Calcutta. And I was just wondering, there must be some biographical elements to your stories, like this one.
Well, usually my stories will have kind of a geographical bio, if I might put it that way, as in I'll set my stories in places that I've been because I really have to know a place well in order to write about it, to feel its ambience, to feel how places change people, because I do believe that we are products in many ways of the places in which we live. So many of the stories that I write are set in places where I've lived. But other than that, you know, the rest is usually fictional because as my teenage children have often reminded me, my life is just not exciting enough to make stories out of.
Well, there's another story in this collection, A Perfect Life, which I thought, nah, that can't be. I don't think this is autobiographical, although there may be some truth in it. I don't know. This is a story of Mira and Richard and this young boy named Krishna. And did any of that, I mean, what inspired that story? Because it was a rather strange story.
Well, you know, that is a story about a young woman who's very, you know, she's living the yuppie dream. She's working. She's making a good amount of money. She has a boyfriend. She has a totally what she calls hassle-free life and loves it. And then this little runaway boy, she finds him at the bottom of the staircase in her building, and she decides to keep him. And so, you know, and she becomes really, really fond of him. They bond, but then is she going to be able to keep him? That's the question of the story, because obviously it's not legal. And her boyfriend is very against it as well. So that story came out of something, you know, I often will take a kernel out of something I see in life and I'll make a story out of it. So that came out of a friend I'd known who had been given this little girl to keep for a while by this mother who was in a very terrible situation and felt that she couldn't keep her baby anymore. And my friend became very, very attached to this girl, but of course legally she was not supposed to keep her. So she had this great dilemma, and you know, she talked to me about it, and out of that came my story. Then people got changed, the ethnicities are changed, the locale is changed, but that longing for a baby that you fall in love with and you know that that baby isn't yours, that's kind of at the heart of this story.
Well, I do want to ask you about one other in your collection, Arranged Marriage, and that is in the story called Silver Pavements and Golden Roofs. And this, you tell the story, this young woman is flying to Chicago to live with her aunt and uncle while she attends college, and she has never seen snow. And, well, for one thing, I thought it was interesting that when she lands, she does something that's very Indian. She shows respect to her aunt and uncle by touching their feet.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very important kind of Indian gesture.
In fact, there are people living here in California who do that when their yoga guru comes to California, or when they go there, out of respect, they kneel and touch the feet of, out of respect for their yoga guru.
Right.
There is, in this story, though, toward the end, you have a section, a paragraph that focuses on hands. And I was hoping maybe you could read that for us. That's on page 56.
Yes. And I just want to set it up by saying that this young woman has come to America to go to college. And she is so excited, you know, when she comes and she gets in the airplane, she's like, it's her first airplane ride, and she's just beside herself with excitement. She feels a whole new life is about to open up to her. And she looks at her food tray, and they have a little almond roca chocolate, and she first decides to save it because she's never seen a chocolate like that. And then she's like, no, I'm going to the land of almond rocas. And she eats her chocolate, and it melts in her mouth, and it's sweet, and she imagines that America is going to be just as sweet. But as is often in stories, things don't work out quite the way she imagines, and she finds out all kinds of things. She is, in fact, the recipient of a racist incident, and she's now shocked by America. She's like, everything here is different from what I imagined. And she's standing out on the balcony at the end of the story, and it begins to snow, and she holds her hands out, palms down, and she's looking. She's looking at her hands. The snow falls on them, chill, stinging all the way to the bone. But after a while, the excruciating pain fades. I am thinking of hands, the pink-tipped blonde hand of the air hostess, as she offers me a warm towelette that smells like unknown flowers. The boy's grimy one, this is the racist incident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The boy's grimy one pushing back his limp hair, then tightening into a fist to throw a lump of slush. Uncle's with its black nails, its oddly defenseless, scraped knuckles arcing through the air to knock aunt's head sideways. And aunt's hand stroking that angry pink scar, which is on her husband's face. Threading her long, elegant fingers, the fingers still of a Bengali aristocrat's daughter, through his graying hair to pull her to him. All these American hands that I know will keep coming back in my dreams.
My guest is Chitra Divakaruni, and she will be in Chico tomorrow for a workshop. And she was reading from one of her short stories, In Arranged Marriage. And before we don't have time to talk much about your novels. You have one, Sister of My Heart. You have a new novel. But what's interesting, too, about Sister of My Heart is you have two, the I in this story is two different people.
That's right. I have a dual narrator story over here, a dual narrator novel. two sisters, quote-unquote sisters, cousins really, but they feel very close to each other, that grow up in a very traditional old family in Kolkata, which is the city I come from, so it comes back over and over in my books. And they are very different. Sudha is the beautiful one, the traditional, demure one, the one who follows all the rules, and Anju is the, you know, she's the defiant one, the rule breaker, the one who's always questioning. And the sister of my heart will follow their adventures as they get married into two very different kinds of families. And it asks the question, it asks, I think, an important question about friendship. What are the limits of friendship? How can friendship continue even if we move halfway across the world from each other? And ultimately, what are we willing to do for our friend? And what are we willing to give up?
Yes, that's your novel, Sister of My Heart. And then you have a new book coming out this month where you have a young woman of Indian ancestry who has never visited India. What's the name of that new novel?
The new novel is called Before We Visit the Goddess. And it's a different form for me. It's a novel in stories. So really, I've combined the two forms that I love so much in this form. So they're all connected stories. And they follow the lives of three generations of women. A grandmother who lives in India, the mother who comes to this country, and the granddaughter who's been born here in America, brought up here, and has never visited India. So, you know, it's about the connections between them, and it's about what we learn from generation to generation. And I think one of the main questions I'm asking in this novel is, what does it mean to be a successful woman? What does it mean to be a happy woman? And does that change depending on when you live and where you live? And does it even change from one part of your life to another?
My guest is Chitra Devakaruni. She is a professor of creative writing at the University of Houston, and she will be in Chico to she will be featured at the Butte College 5th Annual WordSpring Creative Writing Conference. This is a one-day event taking place tomorrow on campus. And you are also, the public is invited. It's for high school as well as college students. But the public is also invited to a reception with Professor Devakaruni this evening at 7:30 at Roots Catering and Restaurant in Chico. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Professor Devakaruni.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
I would also like to thank my first guest, poet and novelist Gudrun Mao, author of From Ashes into Light. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.